relations between the Mishkan and the Egel. We're all about the Mishkan and the people who work there. Okay, so then there's two parshios, Truma and Tetzaveh. Then there is a story of the Egel. And then we have two more parshas, Vayakal and Pekudei, that pretty much repeat everything that we had in Truma and Tetzaveh. So, according to Rashi, hi Amy. According to Rashi, the story of the Egel preceded the story of the construction of the Mishkan. And even though, of course, that would require us to say the Torah is out of order, and the Rambam goes one step further and says that the reason why we have a Mishkan in the first place is because Bnei Yisrael made an Egel. If Bnei Yisrael had not made an Egel, then the Bechorim would have been the Kohanim. Every family would have had a Kohen. And the place of God's service, the place of serving God, would have been in our hearts, would have been every place. This is a commentary that's not so common, but it's a commentary of the Sforno, who says that B'chol makom asher asher shmi avo elecha ve'articha, that the pasuk says that God told us that wherever you come, wherever you go, and wherever you call me, that's my holy place. So it looks to the Sforno that if we limit the holy place to the Beis HaMikdash, that's a sort of a distinction. According to this opinion, the Egel caused God to say, I can't put my Shechina to that extent every place in the world. I'm just going to have to put it in one place. That place at first was Gilgal, then it went to Shiloh, then it went to Nov, then it went to Givon, and finally the fifth city where that place was Yerushalayim. So this is the one opinion that I'm going to spend a little more time on, a different opinion, but again, in a nutshell, this opinion, which I reviewed with Rashi, Rambam, and the Sforno, is that if not for the Egel, we wouldn't have had a Mishkan. It's especially the Rambam's opinion that the Israelites, after leaving Egypt, could not fathom serving God without animal sacrifice. And because of the influence from the peoples of the world, God begrudgingly gave them animal sacrifice after the golden calf showed inextricably that they needed it. They needed some kind of physical manifestation of their service. Okay, this is the opinion of Rambam and the Sforno. Ramban, very famously, and we discussed this somewhat a few weeks ago when we read Parshas Truma. Ramban, very much opposed to this opinion, that such a far-reaching institution such as the Avoda of the temple service should be a b'di'evet, should be something that is not what God wanted of l'chatchila. So Ramban says that God, if this was indeed God's intention, he should have told Cain and Hevel, he should have told Noach that this is not something that I really want. Ramban has to contend, though, with the fact that the construction of the Mishkan precedes the Egel, and then there is story after the Egel. So, actually, Ramban is in a good place. He insists that the Torah is in order, and that the Mishkan was commanded to us before we made the Egel, and the Mishkan would have been given to us if we didn't make the Egel. So, I would just like to briefly explain why then the Torah has to repeat all of these commands of the construction of the Mishkan. In other words, why is Truma and Tetzaveh repeated this week in Vayakhel and Pekudei? So some commentaries say that it's all part of the basic structure of giving us such minute detail in the first place. This is not an IKEA guide, for goodness sakes. It's a law code. It's the Torah. So why is the Torah telling us about sockets, and it's telling us about how to fit this long board into another board, and how to make the curtains, how to tie down the curtains? Why not protect the specialists and the engineers? Why is this in the Torah in the first place? So the answer is that the Mishkan is actually creating a home. The Mishkan is like a bridal canopy. Remember, the first pasuk in Shmos begins, "Ve'ela Shmos b'nei Yisrael habayim b'tzrami Yaakov ish u'beiso ba'." Yaakov came with his house to Egypt. But alas, very quickly, we lost that house. We became slaves. Look at the last pasuk in this week's parsha, the double parsha. Mamash, the last pasuk in Sefer Shmos that refers not to B'nai Yisrael, but Beis Yisrael. We are the house of Israel. We went from a people that were strangers in a strange place to people about to build a house. We're in the process of building a house for God, and in so doing, we become the house. We build a house for God so that he could reside not in that house. No house can contain God, but so that he can reside in us. So this is the Ramban's Chiddush. It's really amazing. Ramban says that after God commanded building the Mishkan, and we made the Egel, so there was a fear, God forbid, that God would turn away from us. And God would say, you know, these people don't deserve my Mishkan. These people don't deserve me to have my Shechina in their midst. So Ramban says that the whole point of Parshas Vayakel and Pekudei is a renewal of the bris. It's a renewal of a covenant. And Rashi doesn't shy away, and neither does Ramban, from calling this renewed covenant, from the words of Yirmiyahu, the bris chadoshah. Yirmiyahu spoke about a covenant with God that was broken because we turned away from him for so long, and he exiled us and kicked him out of his house. Yirmiyahu says. So Yirmiyahu later in the book refers to a bris chadoshah, a new covenant with God. Chas v'shalom, not a new Torah, but a new covenant, a new way that we observe the mitzvahs. Of course, we know what Christianity did with this prophecy. But what Ramban's big chiddush is, that Vayakel and Pekudei is like Yirmiyahu chapter 31. It's a bris chadashah. It's a new covenant, a renewal of the first covenant of Parshas Truma and Tetzaveh. Before those parshios, I reminded you back some 3-4 weeks ago, that Parshas Mishpatim is specifically also called a bris, because we forge a covenant with God when we agree to follow his statutes, and we live in harmony with one another. And we, if you learn Parshas Mishpatim, you become an expert in Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, in Kiddushin, in family law, in tort law, in law. And that is the covenant that we forge with God first. And only then, when our money is clean, then we can use that money to build him a Mishkan, to build him a sanctuary. So that the old covenant, as it were, is Parshas Mishpatim, Truma, and Tzaveh. And then, even after the Egel, we now, Ramban says, forge a new covenant with God that is very similar to the old covenant, but now, allow me to suggest something that I think is so beautiful between the relationship between God and his people through these stories. I mean, basically, to make the Egel right after receiving the Luchos is almost like a bride committing adultery between the Chuppah and getting to the Yichudru. I mean, if you can imagine such a thing. I mean, we just got the Torah from God. The Har Sinai was our chuppah. And now we're already committing adultery with the Egel. What's going on here? All right, so it threatened to really ruin the relationship. And you see the way Moshe, last week's parsha, pleads and pleads on behalf of B'nai Yisrael. And he says, God, I don't understand you. You knew what they would do with that gold and silver. You knew what they would do with all those pieces of jewelry that they took from the Egyptians. You knew what they would do with the spoils of the Red Sea. So why didn't you just move on without all that? In fact, you know, the Gemara says Moshe wished he preferred not to take the gold and silver out of Egypt. That's why God had to like beg him to do it. Aber no, says the Gemara in Brachas Daf Tes. Please, I beg of you, Moshe. I need to take the gold in order to fulfill my promise to Adam. So really, when Hashem said "Al-Acharichin Yetzur B'chush Gadol," it meant the Torah, maybe the land of Israel, but not all that gold. It says God, you gave them the gold; you have to forgive them. You gave them the Yetzirah. You know what we are. You know what we're capable of. So you have to forgive them, and of course Hashem did. So here's the point. Back in Parshas Mishpatim, God told Moshe that I'm going to send an angel to accompany you in the desert. Now, is that good news or is that bad news? Well, in Parshas Mishpatim, it doesn't appear to be anything, it seems to be neutral. God tells Moshe, I'm going to send Malachim, my angel, to walk before you, and ho hum, no complaints. Everyone's fine with that. I'm going to send an angel, and that's good. Now, that can have two different approaches. You can say that an angel of God is nothing but a bureaucrat. An angel is just going to do whatever God says without mercy. So it's worse to have an angel in our midst, because an angel will just destroy us and not have the proper mercy on us. And yet Moshe just felt, listen, there's nothing wrong. If there's just an angel, that's okay. And then here's the thing. After Bnei Yisrael made the Egel, and God says in Parshas Kisisa, Moshe, I have had it with these people. I can't have my Shechina in their midst. So I'm finished. I'm through. They're cast them away. I'll make you a great nation. So Moshe says, God, it's not enough to have an angel accompany us through the desert. I'm not going to accept such a thing. In fact, if you don't come out with us yourself, I'll tell Leinu Mizeh, don't take us out. Just leave us here. I'll work on that. If you're not taking us out, if you're not going to be with us in your own Shechina, none of this angel stuff. So the question is obvious, says Ramban. Why was Moshe okay with the angel following us in Parshas Mishpatim, and yet he loses his lunch over an angel coming with us in Parshas Kisisa? And the answer is that the Egel was in between. There's a lot of things that change because of the Egel. I'll give one particularly interesting example. The Meshech Chochmah says, is that in Shmos, the Torah says, if you find your enemy's donkey just wallowing around and just roaming, you have to return that donkey to its owner. And in Devarim it says, if you find your brother's donkey roaming around, you should take it and return it. Now, if you're supposed to return your enemy's donkey, of course you're going to return your brother's donkey. Well, why the two differences here? So the Meshech Chochmah says, here's the thing. The Gemara in Bava Metzia asks, how can you have an enemy? What do you mean your enemy's donkey? You're not supposed to have any enemies. You're not allowed to hate anybody. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia discusses under what circumstances, what conditions, because someone is an enemy of God, and someone commits averos, and someone's a terrible person. So in such a case, then you're allowed to have a grudge and hate the person. But the Meshech Chochmah says something beautiful. That was only until we made the Egel. Now that we made the Egel, you're not allowed to hate anybody anymore, because that's in our past. Okay, maybe someone from Shevet Levi, because they didn't make the Egel, that are allowed to bear such feelings. But you understand that once the Egel is in our past, we have no right hating anybody because they're less than what we expect. I would say that this might explain why the first two Aliyos this past Shabbos was so huge. Right? Usually the first Aliyah is about 14, 15 psukim, some are 10, 11, 12 psukim. You know, the large Rishon is 20 psukim. You know, Akev told us he's a very big, very Rishon. 20 is the most, 22. But the second Aliyah is also usually pretty short in the laning. There's a large laning, the Aliyahs get bigger later. And yet, the first two Aliyahs of Parshas Kisisa certainly is bigger than the whole rest of the Parsha. But the first two Aliyahs in Kisisa are bigger than Tetzaveh and Truma in the amount of work. Yeah. So it's really quite amazing. Why these two Aliyahs? The two Aliyahs take you well into the Parsha. So the Meshech Chochmah explains that we want to make sure that by the time we read about the Egel, which is finished by the second Aliyah, that it's only a Kohen or a Levi that get those two Aliyahs. You get it? We want to make sure that only a Kohen or a Levi whose ancestors didn't worship the Egel, right, of getting those two aliyahs. So we have to lean very far into the parsha until by the time the third aliyah gets in there, who's going to be a descendant of someone who did worship the Egel. The third aliyah on Shabbos, of course, is a on any day is not a Kohen or a Levi. Therefore, that person can already get an aliyah because we're finished reading about the Egel story. So it's like a blotch on all of our history. Right? This is why we still have Yom Kippur. Because on Yom Kippur, the day that the Israel were forgiven for making the Egel. So the Egel was this breach in our relationship with God. And this is what I would like to suggest to you. This is what Rabban said. Is that as the result of the Egel, which is a veritable trespass in the relationship, and this is how we have to work whenever we hurt people, because we usually hurt people we're close to, right? You disappoint someone, you said something they didn't like, and you, right? So when you say something like that, when you say something like that, that what has to happen is that the relationship gets even better afterwards, right? That you say, if you're willing to forgive me, if you can't forgive me, okay, there's nothing I can do about that. But if you're willing to forgive me, you're willing to move on, I want to make this even better than before. So on this, I'd like to move into another beautiful Nesha Chachma, since the Nesha Chachma is so popular tonight, of something that is not so much in our parsha, but it's somewhat related to our parsha, of this Inyan at least, is back in Parshas Mishpatim. The Torah said that if you have treif meat, what do you do with treif meat? You have to give it to a dog, right? Why a dog? Why not give it to, some other animal? Or why dafka to a dog? So the Gemara explains two answers. One, because the dog didn't bark in the 10th plague. Dogs usually sense when something's in the air. So they didn't bark when the 10th plague was around. They should have been all barking. Right? They say 15, 20 minutes before the tsunami hit the various coasts some years ago and killed many, many people so quickly. The dogs were going crazy. They felt that something was in the air. So the dogs stayed quiet that whole 10th plague, even though the Malach HaMalach was in the air. So they went against their grain to behave like more than a dog. So we reward them by giving food that's more than dog food. Okay, but the Meshech Chochma concentrates on a different reason. And this will all come back to the Egel. The Meshech Chochma concentrates on the following. He says that the Mechilta points out that the dog's job, what was a dog for in the ancient world, is to guard your sheep, right? Get the sheep all herding in the same area, and to guard the sheep from any wolves or anything like that, and then chase everyone away, and that's their job. Guard the sheep. Now, the word treif means that the sheep was attacked. A treif means like tarof tarap Yosef. It means that not nevela. Nevela means that it was sick or it was shot or shot with an arrow. Treif means it was sick. It was torn apart. Right? So if the dogs know that if they get the treif meat, then the dogs will always make a deal with the wolves. They'll always make, it's dafka when you have treif sheep that the dog didn't do its job, right? If the sheep is treif, that means that the dog didn't do it. The last time we should give a dog meat is when it's treif. If the dogs know they get treif meat, they'll always let them. They'll whistle on the wolves to come in. Here, you get that sheep, and I'll get half, and you get half. So the Meshech Chochma says the following. It's a beautiful point. People let us down all the time. Even, especially the people that are closest to us. All right, now if they keep letting us down and that's all they ever do, then we might have to reevaluate the relationship. But if it's someone we love and someone we're fond of and someone that we know is good and we know is kind, and someone lets us down, the first initial response tends to be to get historical, not hysterical, historical. It's to remind all the other times where the person did something similar. Oh yeah, I remember you keep coming late, and that was you were late that time and this time. So when you let me down, so I remember all the other times you let me down. But if the Meshech Chochma says, if we can be in control, we can say, I know this person is my enemy, but I don't deserve to have an enemy, right? Because I was also in the Egel, right? So If we can be in charge of ourselves, and instead of looking at all the other times where the dog let us down, and instead look at all the times where the dog was there for us, the dog stood up for us, the dog protected us, even though this time it let me down, right? So if we can only look at it that way, then perhaps we go a long way in putting the Egel behind us. That's really what it's about in Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is as much a Ben Adam L'Chavero holiday as much as it's a Ben Adam L'Makom holiday. Of course, we're atoning for the breach in our relationship with God from the very first 10th of Tishrei, where we were forgiven for the Egel, until every 10th of Tishrei. But we all know that God doesn't forgive us for the sins we commit to one another, right? So the Mishkan is hopefully a place where we draw close to God by drawing close to other people. That's really what we're hoping. And the Ramban says that as a result of the Egel, we had to be told all of the psukim, all of the commands about building the Mishkan over again. It's sort of like if you would, Radak says in Shmuel Bet, David was told, he asked, he wanted to build a Beis Mikdash, and then he was told he couldn't because of whatever the reasons are. And then he was very gladdened and very, very excited to know that his son would build a Beis Mikdash. A person is never jealous of his son. So, but then after the Maisa Nebuch with Bathsheba, so David was worried that maybe I don't deserve to build this Beis Mikdash. Maybe after the Egel, we don't deserve to build this Mishkan for God. Maybe we don't deserve to have him in our midst the way he said, V'shachanti v'solcham. So Hashem tells David, you know what? You did a good tshuva. Your sin was much worse than Shaul's sin, but you did a good tshuva. I accept your tshuva. I need you, and I want you. And your sin was worse than Shaul's. The Maran Yuma's beginning of the second parak says that David was less of a moral specimen than Shaul, at least at first, for the beginning of Shaul's life. And Hashem tells David, listen, not only will your son build me this temple, but Sheva's son will build this temple. The son you have yet with her will build this temple. So Bnei Yisrael say to Hashem, I know I made an egel, and I'm very sorry about it. And Hashem tells, okay, I'm going to give you the command to build me a Mishkan, and you know what? I'm inclined to tell Moshe, I'm going to send an angel to go with you in the desert. Moshe says, no. I was okay with an angel before the Egel, but I'm not okay with the angel coming with accompanying us now that I know what's in our past, i.e. the Egel. So this is Moshe's reason for accepting the angel in our midst in Parshas Mishpatim, but not allowing it to be maintained in our midst in Parshas. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is to we've discussed before the question of the prophets. The first one to do it is of course Yeshayahu, because he's really the first to speak to the people in mass, as opposed to the prophet just speaking to the king. But the idea that the moral aspect of Judaism is as much, if not more important than the ritualistic aspect of Judaism, which is, of course, exemplified by the ritual of sacrifice, that the moralistic is more important than the ritualistic. Now, it does not mean to say, as many have misconstrued, that prophets like Yeshayahu or Amos were not interested in the ritualistic, mm-hmm. Far from it. It may be that with a Alabatisha estimate that Yeshayahu and prophets like Amos or Micha are maybe 75, 80 to 85% moralistic in nature and Ben Adam L'Chavero in nature, but that's because that was the main issue of the day. Every prophet has to deal with their main issue. The key is that they did not defy or ignore the ritualistic within Judaism. All of them speak about Shabbos, about the observance of Rosh Chodesh. It seems in Tanakh that the observance of Rosh Chodesh was much greater than it is today, and the observance of Shemitah and Yovel and buying back land for destitute owners. And these are all, some of them have a socioeconomic welfare law attached to it, but they're ritualistic in nature. The prophets were very keen on the rituals as well. And so this is not to say, chas v'shalom, that the prophets eschewed the ritualistic, but they considered that the fight of their day was to stress the moralistic side of Judaism. Now, I would like to conclude with our last prophet. The last prophet is Malachi, and he has four topics in his book. I'm not going to get into three of them now, but one of those topics is to rebuke the Kohanim for the way they have rebuilt the temple and the way they're serving in that temple. So this relates, of course, to the end of Sefer Shmos, right? The end of Sefer Shmos is dedicated to finding a house for the Lord. So Malachi, very interestingly, Malachi seems to turn the other prophets on their heads.
Yeah.
What do I mean? Because Malachi complains about Israel not serving God properly in the temple, while not stressing to any extent whatsoever of all of the Ben Adam L'Chavero problems. Perhaps because there weren't any, maybe. I'd like to think that. And I think that because Malachi was the last of all the prophets, he's the last of all the Nevi'im, historically, chronologically, to talk to us. In fact, the first Targum in Malachi says that he was Ezra, right? Now, Ezra is a Kohen. Of course, that is would be in opposition to the opinion in the Seches Megillah that Malachi was Mordechai. Mordechai was from Shevet Binyamin, so obviously they can't be the same. But you see that Malachi is associated with other contemporaries, and his main issue, I think, is our issue. I would seem to think that if there's a problem that of approaching most Jews today, I'm not saying all, chas v'shalom, the problem approaching most Jews, I don't think is the moralistic. I think morally, Yeshayahu would be very proud of us. Morally, I don't consider that Yeshayahu would go into our places and say, what has God with your prayers? Because you're allowing people in operation to go without their medical care, or that you're allowing this poor family of orphans to be sold into slavery, like Amos says, or that this person was evicted and they're living out in the street in the park and no one's doing anything for them. And I don't think that Yeshayahu would say anything like that to us today, right? I think the one who talks to us more today is Malachi. Malachi, who might come into our shoals and wonder, what kind of service is this? So, okay, but this is the issue of the ritualistic and the moralistic within Judaism. Never lose sight of the fact that in Sefer Shmos, the moralistic side was taught first. Ve'ilim mishpatim asher tosim lifneihem. These are the statutes that you should place, not just before the Israelites, but before the Korbanos. Make sure that you always understand that the mishpatim preceded the korbanos in the Torah, and now when we have especially the prophets such as Yirmiyahu, who spoke about Echal Hashem, Echal Hashem, Echal Hashem. If you recall, I'm reviewing now from something we did some time back that Yirmiyahu speaks about the lies that are told about the sanctuary of the Lord. Of course, Yirmiyahu has the last word. It was destroyed. B'nai Yisrael couldn't fathom that God would allow his own Beis HaMikdash to be destroyed. Right? And God says, this Mishkan that you built for me, Shiloh that you built for me, the Beis HaMikdash that you built for me, they're all things. They are all items. They are physical items. Nothing physical can attain inherent holiness. Moshe was trying to teach B'nai Yisrael that very message by breaking the luchos in front of B'nai Yisrael. Right? He said, I'm going to show them unequivocally, I'm going to smash these luchos that God himself made, because the luchos are a thing. They're a physical thing. It can't be holy then because it's a thing. So this explains the the moral of the Beis Hamikdash, that we say that God took his anger out on sticks and stones and wood and the actual physical Beis Hamikdash, and it served us well because then the anger waxed on things and not on us. Right? I'm not sure if I shared with you. I met with an imam once in Hebron. It's a very, very interesting thing. These are Muslims who are they have dialogue with Jews. I was once invited to one of these dialogues. And he's very well intentioned, I must say. They love Avram, they love Sarah, they love Yitzchak, they love Hagar. So he said, "You Jews, you know that there was never a temple in Jerusalem. You know that this city of Hebron is ours and not yours." So I said, "Wait, okay, what you believe? Why are you so sure that that's what we believe?" And the answer is because if you really believed that Hebron was yours, you would have killed every one of us in 1967 when you returned. We were expecting it, right? We came out with the white flags. We were expecting you to dislodge us from our homes. If you really thought there was a temple on the Temple Mount, on the Har HaBayis that you call it, you would have gotten rid of us. You wouldn't have given back the keys to the Waqf, right? You would have gotten rid of us. So I explained to them that, listen, you see, the reason why you feel this way is because you have a radically different worldview and moralistic view of what's important. You give importance to things and items. We give most importance to the human life. The holiest thing is the human soul, because it's in God's image. That can't be destroyed. My fingers, my arms, my feet, they're things. A virus can get into a thing and ruin it, but nothing can harm a soul. That can't be touched. So that soul, the human being, therefore a human being that has a soul in it, is the holiest thing in the universe. Of course, right? It's holier than the Kotel. It's holier than the Torah, right? So that's why when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, Nabuch, it waned some of the anger on people, and then move to things. I'm not sure that you're relinquishing the Kotel would actually save lives, but one life is more important than anything. Okay, so that's part of our moralistic system, and a very crucial message as we're reading five parshios in a row about building God a physical space. He's saying the Kadesh Shimcha Olam. So this Olam serves as a vehicle to sanctify the divine. Kishem Shemakti Shemo Sobi Shmei Marom. The same way that they sanctify the divine up in Shemayim. And the Srofim, the Zohar says, they're Srofim means this Seraph, right? They're fire, the angels made of fire. And they have to cleanse out their mouth with red hot lava. And before they can say Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. But they can't say Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh until we do, right? So it's as if though we're partners in finding the sanctity of God, not only in the Shmei HaShemayim, which of course even the Shmei HaShemayim, as Shlomo said, can't encapsulate God's Kedusha, but we have to try. We're tasked with that. So this is our message, Truma Tetzavik, Yisisa Vayakel Pekudei, to make the covenant even better than it was before, to understand that there will always be Egels. Moshe smashes the Luchos. I just heard it said that it's like the glass being broken under the chuppah, to understand that this couple, they're very much in love, they're going home together tonight, and they can't wait, and they love each other so much. But understand, there will be disappointment in every relationship. But what Moshe did, he was very angry with Bnei Israel, no doubt. What Moshe did after he broke those luchos was to plead without any hesitation for Klal Yisrael. To plead and plead for Klal Yisrael. So that's it. The relationship cannot be broken. It will never be broken. However, I will close out with that. I hope that we can set up schedules for a lot of remote learning. And thank you so much for being here. If you hear me, if you want to unmute now and say goodbye, have a wonderful night, everybody. And Mirz Hashem, keep looking at the schedule, and we hope to do this very often.
Yeah, this
okay,
was
goodbye,
good.
Everybody. Have a good night.
This was good.
Yashar koach. Yashar koach, Rabbi Schwartz.
Good night, everyone. Thanks so much, everybody. Be well. Good night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Good night, Daniel.
Good night.